You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email, sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Gould. Virginia House delegates Rob Bell and David Toscano provided their perspectives on issues that came before the 2011 legislature. Bell and Toscano spoke at the May 11, 2011 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV Secretary Bill Davis.
Well, I'm Bill Davis. I'm the Secretary of SSV, and I want to welcome everybody here today. We've got an excellent program. These two gentlemen always come after the General Assembly and meet with us and tell us what really is going on in Richmond, et cetera. And they're very familiar to all of us, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the introduction. You can read that in your newsletter. Rob represents the 58th District. David represents the 57th House District. I just want to say one thing. We're very fortunate to have two gentlemen who are truly citizen legislators. They give up their time. They both have active law practices. They both have families. And yet they give their time for us to go to Frankfurt and do the people's business. So today, we're going to let each of them tell us about the General Assembly, and then we'll open it up for questions. And I'm sure they're going to welcome any questions or thoughts that you all have. We'll do this after they both are finished talking. So without further ado, I'll give it to Rob.
It's very nice to be invited back. David and I were talking. This is one of the sort of the every year events. If there were more candidates up here, it would feel more like a campaign kickoff. It has in the past, where this is your first chance to maybe have a debate or a forum with your opponent. This year, it looks like it's just David and me. But it's nice to be back. Thanks for having us back. Both of us, I think, as you know, are part-time legislators. That means we go down to Richmond for typically 45 days in the spring, 1 year, and 60 days in the spring the other year. And the rest of the time, we work at our real job, so to speak. And we are both lawyers. He is my landlord. David actually owns the building in which I work. He's never yet cashed that chip in on an important vote, but he always could. And both of us, I think, have been working in the last few weeks since we got back from Richmond to try to reconstitute our law practices. And we were joking when we were told it was an active law practice. That's a matter of opinion. This morning, I was in court yesterday. In court, I've got cases that I'll be working on both before and after this meeting. So it's nice to take a break and do the legislating again. I think most of you know my seat. David will debate this, but my seat is the famous Thomas Jefferson seat. And when he was 25 years old, Thomas Jefferson actually had my position. And if you've had a chance to visit the Capitol since its renovation, especially, I think you know how special it is to work there. It's like working in a museum. Thomas Jefferson built it. It's the oldest elected body in the Western Hemisphere, the second oldest in the history of the world. And so it's a real honor to represent you. Now, this session was you've heard us say this for the last two or three years, and it was true again this year. This session was again limited strongly by the budget. And I think everyone knows that while there's some good signs that the American economy is pulling out of the recession, we certainly have not pulled out of it yet. And we are concerned, of course, that the good signs may not continue. So this was another year where we were very, very modest in our expectations, very conservative in what we did. We did have a little more money than we projected. And so we used the money to undo some of the things we wish we hadn't done last year. And there were some, I'll give you some examples. There were some fee increases that we put on restaurants and health department fees and things like that. They were very modest in size, and so we were able to undo those and return them back to the way they were 2 years ago. We were able to put a little bit of money aside for the retirement fund. I'll talk about that in a second. But otherwise, you won't hear, I believe, any big proposals that David or I are going to talk about. This was not a year that we started the community college system or had a huge new program for college scholarships or anything like that. The state budget is still smaller than it was 2 years ago. And this, you often hear politicians say that it's a smaller budget, and what they mean is it didn't grow quite as fast. This is the real deal. It actually is less money than we expected. And so all of the spending cuts that have trickled down to the local level, police, schools, UVA, all the rest of it, are still in place. We are hopeful that the Virginia economy is in the right place to be if the national economy turns around, but we're still dependent on the national economy. And so we're not at a time when Virginia can do well and the rest of the country founders. We're hopeful, obviously, like everybody else, that the economy will be successful going into the next year. In terms of some of the bills we did work on, I think many of you, and I won't take up too much time unless you have some interest in it, we did work on a change to the protective order laws. And I think everybody in Charlottesville is familiar with the case of Yardley Love. She was the lacrosse student, lacrosse player who was killed last year. And in reviewing what happened to her, one of the things we discovered, and we knew it, but one of the things that we looked at was this question of how easy it is to get a protective order if you're not married to somebody. Historically in Virginia, we've made it very hard. We've said if you're married to somebody or have kids with somebody, we'll let you get a protective order, but otherwise we don't want to have protective orders for you. And what I think we discovered was is that we'd actually been working on it for years, but we just had never kind of decided to really move, and there was some issues that had come up. We said, well, gosh, when someone is dating somebody, maybe that should be something that we cover. Maybe we should make it easier for you to get a protective order if the person you're dating starts to act in a way that's very threatening. So we spent 2 or 3 months trying to define dating. And all of us, I think, are older than the kids these days, but they don't use the same words for dating that we did. And we said, should it be a serious relationship, not so serious relationship? What if one person sees it as a date, another person doesn't? And you could visualize, these are rooms with 50 people in the room, all of them our age, trying to figure out what 20-year-olds are doing with each other. And so finally we said, you know, at the end of the day, I don't really care if they are in a dating relationship, if the person's really threatening. And that was the epiphany, and I wish I could claim credit, and I can't. We had a meeting where everybody kind of just threw up their hands. It was our second or third meeting of this. And finally said, let's just try to get at the conduct. If somebody is threatening somebody in a way that you could prove to a magistrate, why do we care? And that's what we did. And so the new protective order laws that go into place don't mention dating at all. It just says if you are, and there's some language about how serious the threat has to be, reasonable fear of serious bodily harm. If you are that, we'll let you get a protective order, whether you're married, whether you're dating, whether it's somebody at work, whether it's that scary neighbor that just moved in. And that's the new law. And we're going to give this a try. We think it will make it easier. We want to keep an eye on it, because if there's 10,000 protective orders, obviously it doesn't do any good. It's just a piece of paper and the cops can't enforce it. But we think we got the balance as right as we can, and we'll try to we'll fix it next year if we have to. Let me say there's several things we did not properly address this year that we will have to address in the future. And the most obvious is VRS. Are there any VRS beneficiaries in the room? Okay. I think most of you know that VRS is the Virginia Retirement Fund. It has actual assets. It's not like the Social Security Fund that just has IOUs. It's got $53 billion in bonds, stocks, and cash. The problem is that if you project out how much we're going to owe, given how much we've promised, it's $17 billion less than we need. Now, this shouldn't affect anybody in this room, anybody who's already retired. There's plenty of money for you. But down the road, and VRS is my primary retirement vehicle, so I really care about this personally. Down the road, the money would run out. Obviously, we don't want it to run all the way out before we try to fix it. And so we've looked at a couple different ways to fix it. The House, the Senate, the governor all had proposals. We couldn't agree on something. I am very hopeful that we can get to work on this, because to put it in perspective, $17 billion is the amount of the arrearage, and that doesn't mean much to anybody in this room. $17 billion is the amount of money the state of Virginia pays in a given year. That's our general fund, give or take. So if you took every penny we spend for the next year on schools, roads, Medicaid, UVA, state police, prisons, all of it, if you put all that aside, that's how much it would take to make the fund balance. That's ridiculous. Nobody thinks we're going to close the schools, fire the state police, close down UVA, get rid of Medicaid. But that is the amount of the underfunded shortfall. And so obviously this is something we need to start chipping away at, and the sooner the better. And so I'm hopeful that we talked about it a lot this year. Maybe we'll start to get some traction next year and come up with some of the proposals. There's no shortcuts. It's a lot of money. It'll mean we don't spend the money on other things. And so obviously that's the reason people are resistant to it. But I think it's something we need to get at. With that, I'd like to stop, let Dave talk for a few minutes, and then I think we both want to take your questions. Let me just take 1 minute. I know this is the first meeting of this sort since Marvin Hilton passed away. And he always ran such a nice meeting. He was my aide. I think most of you know this. My first year in Richmond, I needed somebody that knew what they were doing, and he was nice enough to sign on for one more year. And I'm sorry he's not here. I miss him. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to you, Dave.
Thank you. And I think I might stand up so I can see people in the back of the room. It's great to be here today, and like Rob, you know, we miss Marvin, and I've known him for a long time. He didn't work as my aide, but I knew him in a lot of other capacities, including this one. It was always great to come here and have him run a fair shop. We appreciate that, and it's always great to come here. I learn a lot by coming here. First thing, I'm trying to figure out, I want to know if you know what district you're in anymore. I mean, you know, we refer to them as our districts, but they really aren't our districts, they're your districts, so it's always good to know who represents you. Now, right now, the 57th district includes all of the city of Charlottesville, and a bunch of the urban ring includes Ivy, Jack Jewett, Freebridge Precinct. But with the redistricting, the 57th district will change. And Ivy, great precinct. God, I love Ivy voters. Jack Jewett, wonderful precinct. I love Jack Jewett voters. They're not going to be in the 57th anymore. They have moved to Delegate Landis's district. Well, the district that Delegate Landis represents will now have those voters. And Delegate Bell, I'd hate to say it, has given me, but he was the one to help draw the line. So to some extent, he has changed the 57th so that I now have the honor, eventually, if I am reelected, God, there's all these qualifications, right, of representing Kale, which is just south of the city, and Woodbrook. So that changes. And, of course, he got some new districts, too. And I think that when it's all said and done, of all of the delegates who represent portions of Albemarle County, I believe I will have the largest single proportion of Albemarle voters after this is all said and done. Of course, I have to get reelected first, and of course, as you know, I am running for re-election, and I'm so efficient that I even forgot my palm cards today. So I'm in great shape. Anybody wants a palm card, you can call my office. I'm glad to supply them. Shows my wife and my 13-year-old son and all the good things that I've tried to do for the 57th District. So now that we've got that out of the way, we are still in session. Technically, we are still in session. And we are going to be called back again for another go-around in redistricting, this time to deal with the congressional districts. And I don't know when we're called back, end of May, early July, 48 hours notice, that's what they give us. So again, lawyers like us who have to go to court in order to make a living just love this experience. You know, where we get a call, hey, you gotta come back. We don't know how long you're going to be there, but please come back to do the people's business. Now, in the session that finished at the end of February, this was a short session. For those of you who don't know, there's a long session, a short session. Long session goes 60 days, short session goes 45 days, and this was the short session. Figure that out. So we ended at the end of February, and what we do primarily in the short session is tweak the budget and then figure out if there are other bills that we want to try to get passed. We didn't do too much with the budget. We have a two-year budget in Virginia, and so when I say tweak, it means adjust the budget in the second year. Of course, there are always debates, and in this time around, the governor proposed a lot of amendments to the two-year budget, some of which were not really near and dear to my heart. And so I opposed them, but they got through the House, and included in that was some cuts off the introduced budget for education, for K-12 education, for Charlottesville and Albemarle, two districts that I represent. Needless to say, I was not pleased with those cuts, and when they got over to the Senate, they got placed back into the budget, and eventually in the conference committee, they stayed in the budget. So Charlottesville and Albemarle got a little bit more that the governor wanted them to get when we started this budget process. That's not all that happens in the budget process, and I'm more than willing to get into the weeds with you if you want to go there to talk about budget. Long and short of it is, until the economy recovers, there's not a lot of money to do anything much with the budget. We have serious needs in the Commonwealth of Virginia. I'm going to get to some of those in a minute. But there's just not enough money. And until the economy recovers, we're not going to have the sales tax revenues coming in to support the level of spending that probably needs to occur. The future. What does the future hold for the next couple of years? Well, again, it's all about the budget and some budget drivers that are giving us some cause for concern in Richmond. Medicaid, single fastest growing portion of the budget. Medicaid is important. It really helps people who are in need, and at this time, there are more people in need than ever before. So the irony is that at a point when we don't have as much revenue coming in because of the economy, we have greater needs of those people who need to have Medicaid. You know, these are, you know, a lot of children, people who are disabled, people who are really poor and can't work. We don't do a lot with Medicaid in Virginia anyway. In terms of our reimbursement policy, that's to reimburse hospitals, medical providers, for services they render to people who are indigent and poor. We are 49th in the country compared to all the 50 states and District of Columbia. We are 49th in terms of our Medicaid reimbursement rate. That's not a very good thing, and we're cutting it all the time. The result is going to be that a lot of doctors, well, we already know that a number of doctors just won't take Medicaid patients anymore. And then for our community, when we cut the reimbursement rate for hospitals, that really hits University of Virginia. And who pays at the end of the day for that? Well, the taxpayer pays in another fashion. So we're having some real problems with the Medicaid issues and the funding that's necessary to support Medicaid. Issue number two, and again, this is one that's big for our area, higher education. If you look at how the state has been funding higher education over the last 10 years, we have not been doing a good job. I refer to it as the disinvestment of higher education in the Commonwealth of Virginia. To the governor's credit, he's tried to draw some attention to this, and we passed a pretty big bill. He called it the Top Jobs Education Bill. But it's basically a shell. It basically sets in place these general goals for what we want to do in higher education. We want to create more degrees in the Commonwealth of Virginia. We want to build more capacity in math and science and engineering. All laudable goals, no money to support any of it, other than what we do right now. If you have seen the tuition increases that have occurred at the University of Virginia, Virginia Commonwealth University, William & Mary, Virginia Tech, you know, you're talking 10 to 20% a year increases in tuition. And for the first time in University of Virginia's history, the cost of education is being borne more by tuition than state assistance. It's the first time. There's a graph that shows the cost of education and then how that's paid for per capita. The state share, it drops like this, the tuition share goes like this, and those lines have now crossed. And what this means is that a lot of youngsters who are qualified to go to institutions of higher learning are going to be in a position where it's going to be more and more difficult for them to go. And if we're going to maintain our competitive edge as a country, we've got to figure this out. And we can start in Virginia by trying to help fund higher education. Issue number three, big issue, retirement. Rob alluded to it. It's a huge issue. We can debate about what it is to have an unfunded liability, whether it's $17.6 billion or whether it's some other number. The good news is those people who rely on it right now or will rely on it in the next 10 years probably don't have to worry too much. But those people who are very young like Rob, if he's worried, you might have to worry down the road whether there's money in the VRS. So that's a big issue for us. And then finally, transportation. We did a little bit about transportation in this session, but not enough. And if you look at this region, I know a lot of people don't like to build roads in this region. I understand that. But if you look at the per capita spending on transportation, our region now is among the lowest in terms of money coming for transportation. And that includes building roads, transit. We've got this train that we started as a pilot project a couple years ago. It's been very successful. You do pilot projects to see how successful they're going to be, and if they are successful, you fund them. It's not clear we're going to fund it. And, you know, Rob has been very supportive of that train in the past. Ed Scott up in Madison, up and down the corridor. The Lynchburg people have been, but we're going to need a full court press to get this in the budget. And the first thing you can do is write a letter to Governor McDonnell and tell him why this train's a good thing. Make sure that it gets in the budget, because if it gets in the budget, we got a good shot at keeping it there. I talked too long, as usual. I look forward to your comments and the exchanges we can have. Thanks very much.
For questions, but I want to remind everyone that we podcast these programs, so make sure you have a microphone when you ask your questions. So,
thanks. I love the Northeast Regional and so forth and so on, but Ken, just bottom line, is that train service almost supporting itself? How much more does the Commonwealth of Virginia have to put into it to keep it going? Percentage-wise?
It's a very complicated question. No train service anywhere in the world supports itself. There is a subsidy involved in every train service everywhere. In fact, no transportation system anywhere in the world supports itself. There's a subsidy built in everything. So the question is, what level of subsidy are taxpayers willing to support? Of all the trains in the country that have a state support, state subsidy, and they're not a lot of them, but they're increasing numbers. Of all the trains in the country that have state subsidy, I think this one is either number one or number two in terms of its operations, in terms of how much money it generates from the fare box, from people taking it. And if you note, the numbers of people who are taking it are far in excess of the projections. So, I had to tell you what the actual number is, I can't tell you that. All I can tell you is that if you're worried about keeping the subsidies low compared to other train services, this one's a good bang for your buck. The other thing is, we don't factor in capital costs. It takes money to build rolling stock. The other good thing about this is we got the tracks in place. This isn't high-speed rail. This isn't the speculative $8 billion for high-speed rail that a lot of people rail against. These are already on existing lines, so it's easy to keep it in place. Rob?
No, I don't on this one. And I think you've got the right metric, which would be we shouldn't do this because people like trains, although people do. It should be the cost effectiveness in terms of moving people back and forth from here to Washington. I think that there's the equation is complicated because you also have to calculate the benefit of taking those vehicles off the road. And what I mean is we are continually building new capacity into our road net to handle the roads, especially up in D.C. If you've been to the Mixing Bowl any time in the last 5 years since it's opened, that was an enormous project to try and get the cars through that sort of Springfield interchange. And the day it was finished, people said, gosh, if we're not careful, we will fill it up. And so there are some additional secondary benefits. It's hard to calculate, but I think you've got the right question, which would be we don't just do it because we think it sounds good or people have this inherent desire to like trains. It's just, is this the right way to move people? So,
our gas tax, I believe, is 17 cents a gallon. Why not make it 20 or 22 cents and fix the roads?
I think that I appreciate your willingness to pay it, but I think that yours is a minority position by a lot, and I think that especially as gas approaches $4 a gallon, the resistance would be stronger still.
Time and time again, and as you know, you get about $50 million a year by raising the tax about a penny, $52 million, something like that. You raise it 10 cents, it's over $500,000. Now, it's estimated that our transportation needs are in excess of $1 billion a year. I mean, people, what is this figure? People throw it out there. I don't know if that's the real number. But we know there are potholes out there. It's pretty clear. We know that our bridges are in need of fixing. That's pretty clear. We know that outside of this area, there need to build roads. I think that there are needs to build roads here, too. But, even if you don't accept the notion that we ought to build new roads here, you ought to accept the notion we ought to build new roads other places, and we have things on the drawing board for here. So I think we have to find new revenue. The gas tax, I think, is a rationally related fee for a service provided, which is road building and support. There's one other thing. One thing we might consider, and people don't want to really think about this, but what if we put in a bill that said that the gasoline cost dropped to $3.75 a gallon, that we would impose the gas tax at that point. Because right now, what's it, 385, 389, 390? You know, nobody would see anything at that point because the price had come down and they'd used to be paying the higher amount. And I think there's some discussions about that around the country.
Following up on that question, I think the gas tax at 16 or 17 cents was set back in 1968. And even if we give it that we were paying $1 a gallon, which I don't think we were back then, it represented 16%. Now at $4 a gallon, it represents less than 4%. And we haven't raised it at all. And so if you take into inflation, and the fact that we can't even maintain our roads now, much less do any capital improvements, I find it hard to see the reason that we won't tax the user of our road system. And it's an equitable tax because it's spread over every user, whether they're in-state or out-of-state. I just find it hard to believe that we wouldn't look at that in a more serious way.
Let me respond. It's not that it's not being looked at. I don't want to mislead anybody. This is part of every single budget debate. It comes up, I believe, every year of the 10 years that I've been there. There's been a bill proposed to raise the gas tax. Now, it is inaccurate to say that we don't have more money. We have a lot more money. I mean, when I came in, these are round figures, and I can get the breakdown for different parts of the budget, but when I came in, the budget was $47 billion a year. It's now $78 billion a year. Now, I've said this before, if I had told you when I got elected that I was going to vote for a $78 billion budget 8 years later, first off, you wouldn't have believed me. Second off, the Republicans would have lynched me and the Democrats would have adopted me. I mean, in other words, what I'm saying is we have more money, I think, than we ever would have predicted. That said, the drivers for the money has gone have not been the roads. It was, I've seen the figure, in 1980 it was roughly the same. We spent the same amount for schools as we spent for roads, as we spent for, I forget what the third category is, but basically the pie was cut that way. It's now a fifth. Instead of a third, it's a fifth. So while schools spending has risen dramatically and Medicaid spending has risen dramatically, we have made decision after decision not to spend the money on roads. Now, you may think that that is right or wrong, but that's where the money has gone. So I guess my thought is the money has increased. If we wanted to swap out one tax for another, some tax that we have too high and increase the gas tax in its place, that's a conversation you could have about tax reform. But in terms of simply increasing the tax so that we bring more money in without reducing the tax on the taxpayers otherwise, I think that's a mistake. And I think it's especially a mistake given the economic and climate that we're in right now.
Gary, yeah, give you some context on this too. There's been a lot of polls done about whether people would support an increase in the gas tax. And a couple of years ago, I saw a poll that said, would you support an increase in the gas tax? And the answer was off the charts, no. And then the second question, creates fear in all politicians. And that question was, if your elected official voted to support a gas tax, would you support him or her? And the answer was like 80% no. So I've supported a gas tax increase for years, so I guess I wasn't listening to the polls. But for other folks, you know, who are very worried about being reelected, that polling data is pretty powerful. And so to the extent that you want to change that conversation, you have to be actively engaged in trying to educate the public to change their views. If you put people's priorities in place, if you ask them to rank their priorities, they're going to probably rank education number one. So if you have this trade-off between raising taxes for education, revenues for education, versus revenues for transportation, you're going to lose. People don't understand that every time their car hits a pothole that ends up with a realignment or a tire that has to be replaced, they are paying. Wouldn't it be better if they paid on a regular basis every time they went to the pump rather than paying for that repair? And maybe that's the next letter to the editor that somebody can write.
Thank you for coming. I'm going to gear down from millions and from billions and trillions. I'm a taxpayer in Albemarle County, and I've decided to do some investigation rather than just moan and groan. I recently became aware of a program. It's called Bright Stars. which the 2010-2011 projected cost was $1,094,577 plus transportation costs. This fee here in Albemarle County applies to 135 children. They get preschool learning. The children come to several county elementary schools for the day, receiving meals and the designated instruction to prepare them for kindergarten. This program runs concurrent with a regular school year. I have a great deal of difficulty with this expense as I learned that the parents have the following educational level. 42% of the parents have a GED or a high school diploma. 3% have 2 years of college. 6% have 4 years of college. And hold your hat, 4% have postgraduate education. And I've given the gentleman the charts that I got out off the computer. I do have a computer. Most importantly, what are these parents required to do for this taxpayer gift? Are they doing any community service? Are these children legal residents of our country? Based upon the demographics, and the chart is in here that I have given them, 28% are Hispanic, Asian, or unknown. I want some payback for my tax dollars.
My experience with Bright Stars comes from being, my son was at a school where there was a Bright Stars program, so aside from that, I've got, no, it's not a statistical, it's just anecdotal. I know it's supposed to be a means-tested program for lower-income kids. I know that's what it's supposed to be. I know they have a handful of mainstream kids in there, I believe, to have the kids have somebody around them who is, in fact, high-performing, just so the kids have somebody to imprint off of. But I think that it's supposed to be for low-performing kids. I don't know about the residency status. I know that the Supreme Court has held that the school systems must provide K-12 education regardless of residency status. K-12, I don't know if that applies to this. I'm afraid I don't have the answers that you're seeking. I don't know if you do, Dave.
I don't have those answers either. I think, you know, part of this we'd have to check with the school board. It sounds like about, well, they have to approve the program, I believe. I mean, it says Albemarle County, I'm just looking on my website here, Albemarle County, Bright Stars is a program of the county schools, I thought. Am I wrong about that? I've always thought that it got funded from this, partly from the state, partly from the locality, but that it is run by Albemarle County Schools, because I've been to classrooms with Bright Stars. Take a look at them. Thank you.
Thank you.
The for the organization, the local organization called Impact, which is a combination of 31 different congregations in our area. We spent 6 months researching pre-K education. Bright Stars is an outstanding program. It is run jointly by social services and the schools. The schools provide the spaces and the social services provides a lot of the support that goes to these parents. The criteria for the children are whether or not they are in poverty, but there are also exceptions where they're looking at kids who will have an extraordinarily difficult time with their education due to some disability. So that there are other criteria that they're looking at. The payback is terrific. They found that if you have a child who gets pre-K education, and their vocabulary increases, their socialization skills increase, their experience outside of the home increase, they are much more likely to succeed in school. Anyhow, the payback comes because those people do not become part of the judicial system and part of the penal system later on. So there's a significant payback.
Okay, we have another question back here. Peyton.
Yes. Recently on Meet the Press, Governor McDonald gave a presentation about how the state had saved $4 billion. His counterpart, David Axelrod, who's Mr. Obama's campaign manager, tore that apart he said it was smoke and mirrors in this $4 billion. Could you guys, maybe you didn't see the program, but could you all give us some idea of what they were talking about and what the truth really is, because we trust you, but that's not David.
I was looking through my book. If you saw me rifling through it, the benefit of you being our first debate is you get us sort of raw. The bad news is we don't have all of our briefing folders quite as organized as we will after the next few. So here's the state budget over the last few years. And the issue, how you score it, is based on whether you score it against last year's numbers or what the projections were to spend. Because understand, Medicaid goes up roughly 10% a year. Other programs expand. You get more students. This is a little technical, but there's something called counter-cyclical programs. Those are the ones that when everybody's doing badly, we have to spend more on unemployment benefits, some welfare benefits. There's even some indication that more people go to jail when times are tough. So there's some things that just when we're running out of money, there's some things that need additional money. So whether what you're comparing it to is how you get to the figure. Let me give you the raw numbers. So the general fund, which is the part of the budget we control, it does not include things where the feds give us a dollar and then we pass it along. That's called a non-general fund. But the general fund is what your sales tax, income tax, home tax, gas tax, all those things, not gas tax, but the other ones go in the general fund. In 2006 to 2008, it was $34 billion. That was the high water mark. It receded, it shrunk to $31 billion in 2008-2010. And then in our most recent budget, it was $31.4 billion. But I suspect that even that number is dated because it doesn't have the most recent figures. And so when they talk about making the cuts, what they're usually saying would be this was what the budget was expected to be. So when Governor McDonnell came in, when he was elected, I guess 2 years ago, the outgoing governor, Governor Kaine, presented a budget. When that budget came through, there were two things Governor McDonnell had to do to make the books balance. The first was the revenue was lower than anticipated. The tax money just wasn't coming in, so he had to make the cuts to balance it. In addition, Governor Kaine included $1 billion in, I don't want to get in an argument about it, tax increases, revenue enhancements, fees, whatever you want to call them, but there's $1 billion more of new money that he was bringing in, and Governor McDonnell says, I don't want to do that. And so the cuts included, in addition to the fact that just the sales tax wasn't bringing in as much as he expected, additionally, he cut out the $1 billion of additional spending, and I'm using a round figure, that Governor Kaine's budget included as part of these tax increases or revenue enhancements. I don't know, Dave, if you've got anything more specific.
Well, you can see how complicated this is. I think the short answer is they're both right and they're both wrong. It is true that Virginia needed the stimulus dollars from the feds in order to make the budget balance. So to that extent, Axelrod's criticism was correct. But it is also true, I think, that there were cuts that were made, very difficult choices that were made that helped balance the budget as well. The other thing that happened was that there was, Axelrod referred to borrowing from the state retirement plan to balance the budget. Technically, that's not really right. I mean, they didn't borrow against the plan. They just didn't fund it. So it's not like you grabbed money out of the plan and brought it in to balance the budget. You just didn't put enough money in there. So, you know, it gets involved a little bit in how people phrase these things, how they spin various things. But there is no issue, I don't think, with this notion that without the federal stimulus dollars, at least well, 2 years ago, we wouldn't have had a balanced budget. That's what kept us from going over the cliff. And we've now said we're not going to accept certain amounts of federal dollars because there's too many strings attached to them.
The good thing about having somebody else speaking is it gives me a chance to look stuff up. So I now have the budget figures for the last 5 years, including the one we just finished. And it was put, is Jordan still here? I have a new aide, and it was right where she said it would be, and I didn't look there. So this is my fault. I apologize. If she's still here, you did a good job. Okay, so the highest spending Virginia has ever had in the general fund, if you're looking at a chart, the absolute most we ever spent was 2007, which should give you some idea of how long this recession has been. So the high water mark, we spent $17 billion in 2007. It then went to 16.9, then it went to 16.1, then it went to 14.7. So if you're looking at the spending that we're spending, you can visualize. I mean, these are all the programs that everybody always asks us for. 15.3, it's all the way back up to 16.6. it is still not as high as it was in 07 or 08. So in terms of the ongoing cuts, understand that every year Medicaid spending goes up. I don't mean we cut it. It increases every year. It's average double-digit increases for the last forever. As school kids come in, we have to increase education spending. I've got a different chart that shows how the education spending has gone up. So that has increased. That has meant the pressure on the rest of the budget has been dramatic. And so everything you hear about cuts to UVA, everything you hear about not having any transportation money, everything you hear about public safety, which no one's brought up, but I can assure you there's similar cuts in public safety, all the other welfare programs, the reason they're getting squeezed is we have the pie is smaller, and the slice of it going to Medicaid and the schools is bigger. So that's sort of the short version. I don't know if that helps you.
I have a question about redistricting in the Commonwealth. Is it your assessment that the districts are more or less competitive as a result of redistricting across the Commonwealth?
We're going to differ on this one, I think. Maybe not. I don't know. They're definitely less competitive. There were some numbers that I'd seen very early in the process where, when we were dealing with the first House iteration of a redistricting bill related to the House. Those numbers suggested that about half, and it could be plus or minus a couple numbers, about half of the seats in the House had Republican performing percentages in excess of 60%. That means that in a typical election in those districts, about 60% of the populace typically would vote Republican. That's in 50 of the 100 House districts. The figures I saw after the changes indicated that that number jumped from about 50 to maybe about 57. That would mean 57 districts had performances in excess of 60%. You've got the same thing happening on the Democratic side, but because the Democrats are in the minority, the numbers in the aggregate are a little bit lower. You take a district like mine. My district has got a performance, Democratic performance level of about 70%, and maybe a little bit less, 60-some percent. It's probably a higher performance level now than before. So even though I voted against the bill because I didn't like the process, the bill helps incumbents. And you only probably have maybe 12, 15 districts statewide in the whole House of Delegates that are really competitive, that are in that margin, 45 to 55%. At least that's my take on it. You might have a different one, but
I don't know. We'll see. I think, does everybody know redistricting is always, I feel like we're talking to 10 people in the room and nobody else even cares or follows. But every decade after the census, we have to make the lines. We have to redraw the lines for the whole map so that everybody has the same number of people. And the reason we have to do that is over the last 10 years, the districts have not grown at the same rate. And so David's was too small. He had grown a little bit, but not as much as the rest of the state. Mine was too big. My area had grown faster. There are some districts that were more than double in size up in Northern Virginia, just farmlands turned into subdivisions. And in some places down in Southwest Virginia where the population was far too small. And I don't know the Senate particularly well, but on the House side, three seats moved from somewhere else to Northern Virginia. In other words, if you look at Southwest Virginia, instead of having 10 seats, there's just not enough people there. Now they have 9. If you look at South side, instead of having 10 seats, they've got 9. If you look at Hampton Roads, instead of having 15, they've got 14. All of those went up to Northern Virginia. And so we'll see. I mean, I think that Northern Virginia is a more competitive area we've seen over the last decade than certainly South Side or the Valley, which has been more traditionally Republican, or the inner parts of the Beltway, which is traditionally Democratic. They're just not competitive seats in Alexandria. I think that we had, I don't want to guess, dozens of public fora about this. And I'll tell you what I've told everybody, which would be competitiveness was one of the things people brought up to us many times. But so was what they call communities of interest. And the best example is right here. My seat has been competitive for the decade. In fact, if you've come to this for the last decade, I usually have a real opponent sitting near me, telling you why I'm an idiot. David's, the 57th, is not competitive. It hasn't been in my adult political life. The city of Charlottesville is obviously a very Democratic place. The nearby parts of the county are a very, very Democratic place. And so the elections in the city have largely focused on who gets to be the Democratic nominee, but once that person is chosen, That's the election. The election takes place in May instead of November. The only way to make David's seat competitive, if that was your goal, would be to split it up into three pieces, maybe four. And I'm not exaggerating, and if you could look at the numbers, you could go see that you'd have to take the city, and it's called slicing a pizza. You take part of the city, part of the county, and part of Greene. The next district is part of the city, part of the county, part of Flavanna. The next one's part of the city, part of Western, part of Augusta. If you did that, you could conceivably make it a competitive seat. I don't know that that's a policy goal. I'll tell you that the governor's nonpartisan commission, which was not political at all, they just drew the maps, they did not make any real effort to make it a competitive seat either. I think they lumped us together, but it would have been your seat. So we'll see. I guess I don't know the answer to that. David thinks they'll be less competitive. I don't want to claim that I know what'll happen.
I wanted to go back to the train because actually it's more than a train to Washington. It goes all the way to New York and Boston. So my question is this up to the governor alone to fund it, or does the House of Delegates also vote on it? Yes? And if so, are you for it?
The first part's easy. It's a part of the budget. We write the whole budget. Some of the funds are dedicated that you have to put in a certain place, but fewer than you might think. And sure, we could put $34 billion into it. I'm not being funny, but I mean, you have the ability to do that. The second, whether I'm for it, I'll answer the question with the gentleman's comment. If the numbers say that it's the most effective way to transport the people and it's the cheapest, sure. But I'm not for it as a sort of a theoretical matter. I want them to show us the data about why it's cheaper than all the other ways that we transport people. I know that there are some places where they've looked at subways versus buses and have discovered that buses are 1/10 the cost of a subway. And people go, how could that be? And you go, gosh, you don't dig a tunnel through. You don't have to buy expensive trains. The parts aren't as expensive. In places like that, I'd be for buses instead of subways. If it turns out that it's better to move people with trains than cars, I'll be for that too.
It's a good point that you make about it goes all the way up in the Northeast Corridor. And actually, when this train got put into place, there was a wonderful deal struck with Amtrak so the state would recover monies from the fare box for people who were originating here but going all the way to Boston. So they're paying for more, and therefore the state's getting more back or greater credit. One of the problems is now the federal government has changed some of the regulations about the funding of trains, and states are going to have to pick up more of the tab. How that's going to work out for Virginia is not clear, because we have more than this train running through Virginia. We've got the Crescent, we've got the Cardinal and running through this area, and then you've got all the trains that run through Richmond. It's going to be very complicated. It is much easier to get this funded if it's in the governor's budget. If you have to rely on the House Appropriations Committee or the Senate Finance Committee to put that in the budget, you know, you're really rolling the dice. We have got to get it in the governor's budget. Unless somebody can show me a reason why you shouldn't build on a pilot program, which seems to be performing much better than anyone expected, now I'm going to support that initiative. I can be persuaded otherwise, but right now that's my inclination.
Real quick, just what he said is important. He's exactly right. In theory, the General Assembly could ignore the governor's budget. He just puts it out there. We write our own from scratch. In practice, we always work from his document. And it means no matter how it happens, no matter how aggressive the General Assembly is, it always ends up being 85% what he started with maneuvering around the edges, but not an entirely new idea. I can't recall one where that's happened. So,
any other questions? No, this is it. Well, thank you all very much.
Thank you very much.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.